Welcome to the IWA podcast, the day after the historic Scottish referendum result. I'm joined by a stellar panel, Professor Roger Scully, Professor of Political Science at Cardiff University and renowned Welsh sophologist, recovering sophologist, Dr. David Tristan, the Chair of Plaid Cymru, and Cathy Owen of the Public Affairs Consultancy Deirin and former Yes campaigner. I'm Lee Waters, I'm Director of the IWA. Roger, let's just kick off with your analysis 24 hours later of the result.
Well, I think the one obvious very good thing that we can say about it is at least there was a clear result. You know, we didn't come down to recounts or, you know, something being so close there were questions about the legitimacy of the result. That's one, I think, thing that is definitely good. Clearly, given how close they were, or even in the lead in one or two polls over the last 2 weeks, the Yes campaign will be deeply disappointed with the result. However, I think if you look at it in a wider perspective, it was actually quite a considerable achievement for Yes to get that close. You know, if you look at the disparity of forces on the two sides, I mean, the Yes campaign had parties representing, the Yes campaign represented parties who won 21% of the Scottish vote at the last general election. The No campaign included parties that got 78% of the Scottish vote at the last general election. The No campaign also had nearly all of the print media on their side. Actually, I think, you know, given that, given the huge status quo bias there generally is in constitutional referendums, it was actually quite a significant achievement for Yes to get to 45%. And, you know, I think a year ago, few people would have actually expected them to do that well.
But given all that, the polls were still showing, right up to the end, that this was too close to call, famously. Were the polls wrong? Was there what was called in 1992 a spiral of silence? Was there a late shift to the No campaign?
I think the pollsters had an extremely difficult job to do in a referendum where voter registration had spiked up so much and there was such a high voter turnout. Looking at the very last polls that came in, there does seem to have been something of a drift back to No in the last few days. I think that probably accounts for some of the tendency of most of the polls to overestimate the Yes vote by 2 or 3 percentage points. Maybe, you know, they will also have to look at how they calibrate their models a bit. But, you know, most of them were not out by very far. The slightly disturbing thing is that they're all slightly out, but in the same direction.
David, what were your assessment of the Yes campaign and its achievements?
Well, I think Roger's comments are useful and illustrative because they reflect the very significant historical success of the Yes campaign, and that sounds odd given the result, but considering from where they were coming and the challenge that they faced, there is no doubt that the Yes campaign galvanised new voters, it brought new people into the political process and was effective in portraying a narrative of hope. It was interesting again to hear talk of 92 and what was there any comparisons to 92. I think one of the lessons I take, and there's been some polling published already today, which suggested that the motivation of those that were voting Yes was to do with creating that better Scotland on a principled basis, that they believed that people within their own country would make better decisions for good or ill. I mean, but that was their motivation. But for those who were voting No, it was to do with fear about the pound, about those negative potential consequences of independence. And in a way, that speaks to the success of the No campaign, because they made considerable play of some of the major risks of independence, and the polling out today suggests that those risks and those fears were actually reflected in people's votes. It was a minority of No voters, according to those polls, who felt sort of a great attachment to this sort of to the union of Great Britain, but rather it was almost better the devil you know rather than the devil you know you don't, and that's an interesting reflection, I think.
David, I think I might have to challenge you on that point, because I don't think that's exactly what those exit polls are saying today. I think those exit polls are more to do about which came first in terms of priority. So I don't think it's just a minority. I think that, that played quite importantly for a large number of people. It was quite interesting that there was an element of identity, but it wasn't the first thing, as you say, on both sides. And that's quite an interesting lesson for the nationalist movement, I think, here in Wales. It can't just be about an identity issue, nation building and those sorts of issues. It has to be about more than that. And I think if the nationalists here in Wales are going to become more successful, as they have been in Scotland, then I think they're going to have to take that into account.
As somebody involved in running a referendum campaign, Cathy, how do you think the No campaign played it?
Badly. I think there's lots of things that they could have done a lot better. As you have suggested, they clearly did realise at the beginning that they had to reflect some level of positivity in order to challenge the position that that trying to make people vote no isn't automatically a positive campaign. But they didn't stick to their guns as well as they might. That said, you know, the Yes campaign also had a dual message. It wasn't just about the positivity. It was also about the risk to your nation of these awful people in Westminster carrying on running our nation. So I think it was interesting for me as the sort of the person that was sort of involved in the logistics and the management and the coordination and the numbers. What I think is quite interesting is Alex Salmond will now, well, it won't be Alex Salmond, but if SNP will be going into the next election in Scotland with a sort of 100% voter contact database. And I'm guessing with the three cross-party campaign for the No that they haven't been able to get together in quite that same way to build that database because there would have been nervousness about sharing voter intentions. So I think that, you know, might have a statistical impact on going forward on any future election.
David, it's that mechanical bit that really interested me. What surprised me most about the result is that I've been hearing stories for many months now about the Yes campaign had a formidable ground operation. They had 2 years to build up this grassroots operation, their public meetings, everybody was attending, the No campaign couldn't get anyone to come to their public meetings. These are the stories we've been hearing. And yet on the night, even on a very high turnout, they couldn't get their vote out.
Well, the first thing to say is that both campaigns got their vote out in historically high numbers. What happened was there was a differential, not a huge one, but a differential between Yes and No voters. But, and I think this is an important point, what the Yes campaign, and it reflected the kind of constituency the Yes campaign was speaking to, was trying to get voters who previously hadn't voted, who were poorer by and large, who were by and large less educated, and there was a whole constituency there of people who do not generally vote. And that the Yes campaign managed to get a large proportion of them out is a testament to the success of the campaign. But as happens in elections, if you've got people who have degrees, who are middle class, and particularly who vote Conservative, they are generally more likely to turn out and vote. And that's what we saw. So I wouldn't be too downheartened. I would always look to the differentials in turnout. What was the difference between sort of your ultra middle class person with a very nice house in Penarth or something and your sort of your poor person on a council estate in the middle of the valleys? And actually the differential in this referendum was much smaller than it is in a Scottish Parliament election or indeed in a National Assembly election. So yes, the turnout ground game at first sight was lost by the Yes campaign. But if you look in context, I think they probably did a pretty good job.
Just a couple of thoughts on that. I think one thought is, you know, when turnout gets that high, when it gets up to 85%, you know, when almost everyone is voting, possibly get out the vote operations thing don't actually matter that much because people are voting anyway. Another thing is, though, I think what may well have been happening with a lot of these, you know, very enthusiastic public meetings, you know, maybe it was generating an even greater degree of fervency amongst people who were going to vote yes probably anyway, mm-hmm. rather than necessarily reaching out beyond the community of people who are favourable to yes and persuading large numbers of other people to come over to yes. I mean, I think, you know, clearly they did persuade some people. Their poll ratings in general went up over the last few months. They reached 45%, but clearly that didn't extend far enough.
Okay, so moving on now to what happens next. David Cameron this morning with, on the face of it, an expansive reaction, saying that there was going to be a process to deliver the Home Rule for Scotland, as Gordon Brown promised, as well as a cabinet committee to address the English question. David, where do you see Wales fitting into this?
I think it's crucial that Wales has a clear role, a clear seat at those negotiations. In fact, it's the kind of role that 2 or 3 years ago, had the UK government set up a constitutional convention, a la sort of Carwyn Jones's proposal, Wales clearly would be represented at those negotiations. It is going to be a challenge because all of the focus is on Scotland, but sort of the, what I might term the sensible unionists, those who wish to see the preservation of the United Kingdom for the next 50 years rather than the next 5, realise that what you need is a stable constitutional settlement and some form of home rule all round, or sort of quasi-federalism, or whatever you want to call it, where the people of Wales can make their decisions, the people of England can make their decisions, and the people of Scotland and Northern Ireland likewise. So to get to that position, you need to involve as many people as possible, and indeed as many actors as possible. And therefore, if Carwyn Jones is sensible, he'll bring together all of the parties in Wales into that pattern to speak with one voice on behalf of Wales.
Cathy, Carwyn Jones has clearly failed to persuade David Cameron to set up a constitutional convention, but he has very late in the day persuaded Ed Miliband to set up one if Labour win the general election.
Well, actually, I am pretty thoroughly depressed by both Cameron and Miliband's statements today. I think you can read between the lines that they're both saying, to some degree, yes, we are going to keep to our promises on devo max for Scotland. Yes, we are going to look at devolution within England and what we need to do about that. And yes, isn't Wales nice? And I think what they're saying is, you know, David Cameron reiterating already, oh yes, we are already giving more powers to Wales. I think what he's saying is, you're getting Silk One in the Wales Bill, we're already moving for you, that's pretty much it. And if you think about it, what is our bargaining power? We are not rich enough, and the Nationalists aren't strong enough as a movement here, in comparison to Scotland, when you compare plight to SNP, and that Nationalist vote, I don't really mean the party, I mean the vote itself, to threaten to secede. Therefore, what is our bargaining power? Our GDP is 25% of that of the UK. We're not going to reach that. So what is it that Cameron can say to Cameron? I know they had a conversation this morning about it. What can he say?
I'm pleased to see Cathy say that the strength of the Welsh bargaining position is a function of the votes for Plaid Cymru, which is a good reason for voting Plaid Cymru. But there is another important point there, which is the focus on the Welsh economy. And the one of the interesting things about the package of powers, if a package of powers can be delivered to Wales, there's talk about corporation tax being devolved to Northern Ireland, if those kind of powers could be devolved to Wales, we can go about beginning to tackle the poor economic performance of the Welsh economy. And if we could do that, we would put ourselves in a stronger position. Now, that's not easy. That's tough. And how do you get from here to there is a tricky road. But we have to try. Otherwise, Wales could well be in this poor sort of peripheral position for another 100 years or whatever. So I think there is a job of work to be done there, both for Plaid Cymru and our friends in other political parties.
Roger, you've been involved in the project about public opinion in England. Mm-hmm. What's your assessment of how England's going to react to this and the promise of protecting the Barnett formula for Scotland?
Well, the survey evidence we've gathered in England, albeit a little while before the referendum, has tended to suggest that the prevailing mood in England was rather sort of unforgiving in relation to Scotland. Whether Scotland voted yes or no, the mood essentially, look, you're on your own, don't count on any help from us, and if you stay within the UK, well, we still we want to get rid of Scottish MPs voting on English matters, and we want to cut the apparent level of overfunding that Scotland gets. So the prevailing mood in England didn't seem particularly warm. We've already seen today several members of Parliament, not just Conservatives as well, but I think one or two from Labour also, indicating that they expect to see some sort of resolution for the West Lothian question and the funding issue addressed. And this is shaping up to be a really potentially very difficult problem in immediately, perhaps most obviously for David Cameron, but maybe in the slightly longer term, the party I think really is potentially in a great deal of difficulty here is Labour. As the one party that still has serious levels of support and representation in England, Scotland and Wales, and it could really find itself being pulled in three separate directions.
Cathy, there's growing signs of alarm in the Labour Party as the implications of the so-called English Vote for English Laws settles into their minds. Ed Miliband, Ed Balls is quoted as being unhappy that this means effectively a future Labour government would not be able to pass a budget in England. Do you think this concern could well turn the Labour Party against the further moves for devolution?
I think it's an absolute nightmare in terms of what the members of Parliament will be saying to Ed Miliband and how different that will be from, let's say, Cadwyn. And I think this will have galvanised them, not just in the Labour Party, of course, we're talking about the Conservative Party as well, but that sort of panic in the last 2 weeks, that, coming out with all those suggestions of what they're going to be doing, absolute promises, absolute vows, without any... So we are not at the table. And I think it's going to be very difficult to have that consensus here that's going to deliver anything unless the MPs are on board. And I think the Nationalists are going to have to take that on board too and work with the grain of that if they are going to help achieve what we need to achieve.
Well, that's my next question, David. If there is a watering down, and whatever the motivations for the watering down, what of this 200,000 plus new voters who have been energised to vote for the first time in Scotland, who are enthusiastic about independence by and large, who feel bitterly disappointed today? If there is further rowing back by the UK parties on the pledges they made, what do you think impact that could have on politics in Scotland?
Well, I think there are two things. I'd be as worried about the tens of thousands of Labour voters who took Gordon Brown and Ed Miliband at their word on the vow that these powers would be delivered, who would be pretty furious if they are not. So, I mean, my anticipation is that a large measure of what has been promised will be delivered to the people of Scotland. So, I mean, because it could get very nasty very quickly if they don't. The other point, though, is what's going to happen to those new voters? I hope they get engaged in politics. And, of course, it wasn't only the SNP that were engaging people. It was the sort of various forms of socialist parties. And the Greens had a particularly good referendum campaign, I'd say. So I think we might see a more pluralist Scottish Parliament in 2016 as a result of... I mean, I think the SNP will do fine out of these new voters too, but I also think there are people who've been engaged by the Greens, by the Socialists, and that will be a good basis for 2016 too. So we'll see. But Powers, I think they will be a great reticence amongst the senior leaders, as seen by Cameron, to roll back on those absolute vows that have been given in panic.
But, I mean, I agree wholeheartedly with David there, but there could be great problems with whoever is Prime Minister after the next general election being able to deliver. Mm-hmm. Whoever's going to be Prime Minister is very unlikely to have a commanding parliamentary majority. They are likely to have significant elements of their parliamentary party unhappy with more or less whatever is proposed for the various parts of the UK. I mean, if it's Ed Miliband with perhaps a very small majority, one could well imagine that quite a few of his Scottish MPs will not be particularly happy at the thought that they might be becoming further marginalised by extending devolution. And he may well also face a significant element of discontent from his English parliamentary party as well. My overall feeling, today is that one problem for the UK was sort of closed down last night, and about three or four other new ones have opened up today. There is no very obvious path from where we are now to a stable constitutional settlement that is politically achievable. whatever kind of set of proposals you look at, whatever timetable you look at, there seem to be sort of troubles innumerable.
Okay, let's finish on the news that Alex Salmond is to stand down as First Minister, triggering a contest for the leadership of the SNP. Cathy, your assessment of Alex Salmond?
Well, obviously, to have reached this far, in terms of doubling the level of support, I suppose, if you think about it, in terms of numbers, then he has to know that he has an amazing legacy for the nationalist movement in Scotland. In a sense, he's won either way. He didn't exactly get what he wanted, but he has, again, moved on the number of powers that Scotland will have. I don't think there's any suggestion it's not going to be Nicola Sturgeon, whether they'll have a contest or not.
Okay. David, clearly a strategic victory for Alex Salmond, but there's some evidence to show that he was a Marmite character and certainly put a lot of voters off. Is he culpable?
Well, I think if you've been leader more or less of your party for a quarter of a century and more, then you are going to annoy some voters and you're going to enthuse some voters. Alec clearly played a huge role in the referendum, but also in that journey. If you can imagine where the SNP were after sort of in 2003, they've come an awfully long way from even within the last decade. Not only sort of from the times when actually Plaid Cymru had more MPs than the SNP in Westminster in the early 90s. I mean, it's hard to fathom that today, but that was the position. So I think Alex Salmond can probably retire. I don't know what his plans are. Very confident in the legacy he leaves to the next generation, and it'll be down to that generation to see what happens next.
Roger.
I think Alex Salmond is one of the outstanding politicians in these islands of the last half century. Obviously, one isn't likely to get many particularly warm write-ups from most of the British press, but yes, he lost, but to have come that close to winning, given the scale of the battle that he was taking on, I think is impressive. You know, I think the SNP's victory in 2011 is possibly the most remarkable election performance I've seen in my lifetime of watching elections. And
and presumably, back to Cathy's point about the get out the vote, on the practical level, what he's achieved puts the SNP in a very strong position to capture the next Scottish Parliament
election. Well, it leaves an SNP that is not only the largest party in Scotland in terms of membership by some way, has an obvious and very talented successor to him, has achieved fairly considerable degree of unity amongst its leadership, and is an extremely well-organised political force. And that's not a bad legacy to leave.
Plus, the first woman First Minister.
Wouldn't be bad.
We can all agree on that one, can't we?
Yeah.
David Tristan, Roger Skelly, Cathy Owens, thank you very much. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the IWA podcast on iTunes.